I'm sure you've heard the expression, that's a big if. It's such a tiny word, right? If, just two letters. Yet so much hangs on it. Now, it's a logical term. It often is used in a conditional statement. If this, then this other thing. If it rains, then the ground will get wet, right? If it rains, the wetness of the ground is dependent upon the whether or not the condition is met. If it rains, the ground will be wet. Now, think of all the possibilities in the scenarios in your life that are connoted by the word if. Let your imagination run wild here for a moment with these following if sentences. Sort of let your mind fill in the blanks. If I had not taken that job. If she had just left 10 minutes earlier. If that person had never hurt me. If I had said no. If I had said yes. If we had never met. The possibilities seem endless. Think of how easily two simple letters can completely change a person's life. We frequently, because of this, think we are victims of bad luck or chance or the decisions other people make, their choices, their actions. Think of how many thens there are in your life because of someone else's ifs. Sometimes it's easy for us to feel like a pawn in all this and all the if-thens of life, like we're a chess piece being moved around according to someone else's will, including God's will. We get stuck in a whole host of, if I hadn't done this, then, or if she would have done this, then, if they were to, then. Well, my prayer this morning is that you and I both will see the beauty and the glory of God's sovereign rule in our lives today, even when the if in our lives is our own choice to disobey. We're in Judges 15. Then the Philistines came up and encamped in Judah and made a raid on Lehi. And the men of Judah said, "Why have you come up against us?" They said, "We have come up to bind Samson, to do to him as he did to us." Then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock of Edom and said to Samson, "Do you not know that the Philistines are rulers over us? What then is this that you have done to us?" And he said to them, "As they did to me, so I have done to them." And they said to him, "We have come down to bind you that we may give you into the hands of the Philistines." And Samson said to them, "Swear to me that you will not attack me yourselves." They said to him, "No, we will only bind you and give you into their hands. We will surely not kill you." So they bound him with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock. When he came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting to meet him. Then the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and the ropes that were on his arms became as flax that has caught fire, and his bonds melted off his hands. And he found a fresh jawbone of a donkey and put out his hand and took it, and with it he struck 1,000 men. And Samson said, "With the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey have I struck down 1,000 men." As soon as he had finished speaking, he threw away the jawbone out of his hand, and that place was called Ramath-Lehi. And he was very thirsty, and he called upon the Lord and said, "You have granted this great salvation by the hand of your servant, and shall I now die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised?" And God split open the hollow place that is at Lehi, and water came up from it. And when he drank, his spirit returned, and he revived. Therefore, the name of it was called En-Hakkor. It is at Lehi to this day. And he judged Israel in the days of the Philistines 20 years. Last week, we saw Samson's act of vengeance against the Philistines for murdering his wife and his father-in-law. He had returned to Timnah, you may recall, to claim her after storming off in anger during the wedding reception. He wants to consummate his marriage, but he discovers that his father-in-law has already married her off to someone else. Now, in response to this offense, Samson burned the Philistines' grain crops and several of their olive orchards. This was an act of cruelty on his part because he harmed many people who had nothing to do with his father-in-law's behavior. The economic fallout of this in Philistia would have lasted years because the grain at that time was in the process of being harvested for the coming year, and now it's simply gone. They would have little for planting the following season, and little to eat this season, and since they were largely an agrarian society, their food supplies and their economy would have suffered greatly. Samson was right in being angry, but he showed zero restraint in his response, preferring personal vengeance over true justice. Well, the Philistines, of course, were angry at this outrage, and like Samson, rather than confront the one responsible, they murdered the woman and her father, just as they had threatened to do at the wedding feast. In hot anger, Samson then uses his supernatural strength and his divine empowerment to attack them with violence and with ferocity. And then when his bloodlust was temporarily satisfied, he went and hid in Edom in Judah. Now, in all this, we have to recognize God is at work. God appeared to Samson's mother, and remember, she had been barren, and God promised her a son who would be consecrated to the Lord his entire life. And while she was pregnant, and while she was nursing Samson, she would be under a Nazarite vow, forbidden to cut her hair, forbidden to touch a dead body, forbidden to consume any alcohol, including anything made from grapes. This is because Samson would be under a Nazarite vow, not only that time, but his entire life. He was to be completely and thoroughly consecrated to the Lord, set apart for the Lord's service. God directly chose Samson to deliver the Israelites from the oppression of the Philistines. We saw as he grew, the Lord was with him. The Lord was stirring him to act. He saw the idolatry of his own people. He saw the oppression at the hands of the Philistines. He saw the suffering of being under the thumb of the pagans who worship false gods. He was blessed by the Lord with supernatural strength. He was stirred to do something about it. But then we saw that his first official act as a judge for Israel was to lust after a Philistine woman and demand his parents arrange for her to be his wife. But remember, we read these words right after this. His father and mother did not know that it was from the Lord, for he, the Lord, was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. At that time, the Philistines ruled over Israel. What we're seeing here is God is pursuing his purposes, whether or not his chosen and consecrated servant is willing to participate. God is seeking an opportunity to throw off the yoke of the Philistines. Samson's miraculous birth was God's action toward deliverance. God could do it all by himself, of course, but God, in his wisdom, chooses to use means. He gave Samson to Israel. He consecrated Samson from birth. He supernaturally strengthened Samson. He gave Samson physical gifts that are simply unparalleled in human history, and he divinely empowered Samson with his Holy Spirit, all so that Samson would bring about the deliverance of Israel. Instead of being the deliverer of Israel, Samson hid himself. He was petulant and angry and utterly unwilling to truly fight against the Philistines in order to deliver Israel. Oh, he was willing to fight for petty vengeance, but fight to rescue Israel from its oppressors? Nah. Our story picks up sometime after Samson's revenge. In verse 9, the Philistines invade Judah. Now, Judah borders the tribal territory of Dan. Now, we know the story of Samson takes place very early in Israel's time in the land because the tribe of Dan has not yet moved further north. That happens in chapter 18. So this is within a generation or two of Israel conquering the land. So rather than pursue Samson directly, the Philistines invade Judah and make a raid on a city or a village called Lehi. Now, the raid would be to steal grain, in part. They were taking from Judah what Samson had taken from them, tit for tat, an eye for an eye. Surely, they took other things to which they were not entitled. I mean, they were Israel's oppressors, after all. There's a reason God is seeking to deliver his people from the thumb of the Philistines. God is seeking to deliver them. Well, the men of Judah approach this invading army, and they ask him essentially, like, guys, what's up? Why are you attacking us? Well, notice what they say in verse 9. We have come to tie up Samson so we can do to him what he did to us. Violent retribution. That's what they're after. We're going to do unto others as they do to us. We're going to love our neighbors as they love us. We're going to, you want to hurt us? We're going to hurt you. Going to mess with us? We're going to mess with you. Going to break our stuff? We're going to break yours. It's interesting, they don't go to Samson directly. It's likely they're afraid to. I mean, after the beatdown he gave them single-handedly, back up in verse 8, they don't want a direct confrontation with Samson. So they attack Judah, hoping his own people would subdue him in order to avoid further trouble with them. They got what they were hoping for. 3,000 men from the tribe of Judah go to Samson at Edom. And the first thing they say to him is, don't you know that these people rule over us? What are you doing to us? They don't say, man, I really hate those Philistines. Let's go get them, Samson. With you as our leader, surely we can crush them. They certainly don't cry out to the Lord for deliverance. They don't demonstrate anything that looks like faith. With 3,000 men, they're an army. I remember what Gideon did with just 300 men. They have 10 times as many, and Gideon's army only played trumpets, and God gave them overwhelming victory. God can use these men with Samson's leadership, and he can eliminate the Philistine threat once and for all. And remember, the only thing Israel ever really had to do was engage in the battle. That's it. Back in chapter 1, we saw this. When the author lists all the nations that Israel did not drive out, that they did not conquer, that if they would have just engaged in the battle in faith, God would have given them the victory. When Israel engaged in battle in faith, Israel was victorious. When Israel refused to engage in the battle in faith, Israel was not victorious. Remember, Samson is early in Israel's history in the land. And here we have, once again, Judah is at the forefront. Do you remember how the book began? Very opening verses. After the death of Joshua, the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight against them? The Lord said, Judah shall go up. Behold, I have given. I have given. Right? I have already given the land into his hand. All you got to do is go take it. God has been seeking opportunity to engage the Philistines in battle that he might give the victory to Israel so that Israel would continue to cleanse the land of its idolatry. Remember, the Philistines' religious furniture, their idols, their carved images, altars, temples, and such, that would all be destroyed. The people wouldn't be slaughtered. That was never the purpose of the conquest. False worship in the land God gave Israel would be destroyed. But now, God has a small army, and he loves small armies. He has an incredibly gifted and capable deliverer in Samson. God has brought about the opportunity to deliver Israel. All that's needed is faith to engage in the battle. Well, after being confronted about stirring up trouble, Samson responded, well, as they did to me, so I've done to them. What does Samson really want here? Violent retribution. That's all he's after. He's going to do unto others as they have done unto him. He's going to love his neighbors as they love him. You're going to hurt me, I'm going to hurt you. Going to break my stuff, I'm going to break your stuff. Mess with me, oh, I'm going to mess with you. You see, Samson is a Philistine. He's ethnically an Israelite from the tribe of Dan, but he thinks like a Philistine. He conducts himself like a Philistine. He pursues vengeance like a Philistine. He pursues his own physical desires like a Philistine. He dishonors God like a Philistine. This is contrary to the purpose God put Israel in the land, and it's contrary to Samson's purpose, his entire purpose in this world, a purpose given him by God himself. Remember, Israel was placed in the land to show the nations what Yahweh, God of Israel, is like. This is why they're given the law of Moses, right? The law of Moses was not given as a mere list of rules to follow, but is a description of what Yahweh, God of Israel, is like. If they would live in a manner that was like Yahweh, God of Israel, Israel would fulfill its purpose in the land. Their purpose in the world was a missionary purpose. By living according to God's character as revealed in the law of Moses, they would show the world what God is like. Even the conquest was to show the nations the glory of the God of Israel. Now, if the people occupying the land insisted on armed resistance, Israel would show them the futility of resisting the God of Israel, of trusting in carved images, because God would give Israel victory after overwhelming victory. If the nations wouldn't give up their idolatry, Israel would take it from them and show them over and over again that Baal and Ashtaroth and Dagon and Asherah and Molech and Anath and Maat and all the other gods are no gods at all. How would the nations know this? When Israel would trust in the Lord and would face the hostile nations in armed combat, Yahweh, the God of Israel, would be victorious every single time. I mean, it didn't have to come to this, of course. Anyone could freely turn from idolatry to worship the one true God. All were free to worship Yahweh, God of Israel. None of the nations, not one of them, was forced to resist the Lord. If any insisted on armed resistance, they would be met in battle, and the God of Israel would demonstrate his power, just as he did with Egypt. And as with Egypt, the mixed multitude, regardless of ethnic origin, were free to join the people of Israel in worshiping the Lord. This is how it was supposed to happen. They were supposed to turn from their idolatry. Israel was chosen by God to represent him to the entire world. They would, by trusting in him, show the world what he's like. That's why the law insisted on things like justice for the poor, justice for the sojourner. This is why the law insisted on ritual purity. This is why the law insisted that Israel as a people would live differently from the nations around them. By being transformed people, they would proclaim the good news of who God is to others, who would then be compelled to also worship the God of Israel. This is not what happened. Remember that the book of Judges, again, is not in strict chronological order. Samson is one of the earliest judges raised up by God to deliver his people. Now think about that. Why so early in their history in the land? Why do they need deliverance from their enemies? Remember what we saw back in chapter 2. As soon as the generation that knew Joshua and had witnessed the miracles of God in their entering the land, the next generation, we're told, did not know the Lord and went after other gods. The very next generation. That's how quickly Israel fell from following the Lord. Well, now they're led by Samson, the Philistine, the one who embodies all that it means to be an Israelite. Rather than showing the nations what they would look like if they followed the Lord, he and all Israel chose to show the nations what they actually look like. Rather than shining the light of the glory of God on them, they were but mirrors to the nations. When the nations looked at Israel, rather than seeing the light of God shining upon them, they saw themselves. So 3,000 men of Judah go to Samson and demand his surrender. They should have pleaded with him to lead them in battle. Instead, they plead with him to go quietly. Rather than be delivered by Samson, their plan is to deliver Samson into the hands of the Philistines. Now, Samson, for his part, doesn't bat an eye. He has no fear of the Philistines. I mean, he's Samson, after all. He simply doesn't want his fellow Israelites to harm him. So he asks for their assurance. But they promise him they won't harm him. They're just going to tie him up and deliver him into the hands of the Philistine army. The author says they bound him. They tied his arms together like handcuffs, right? Now, given the plants that were available in that era, in that region, they certainly were made these ropes out of flax. Flax fibers are among the strongest and the longest natural fibers on earth. Being long fibers, they make for really strong rope. And new flax, wet flax, is at its strongest. The author says they bound Samson not just with a flax rope, but with a new rope. They used the strongest rope available. In fact, the author says they used two new ropes. That's double the strength. They led him to Lehi, where the Philistine army has set up camp. When the Philistines see Samson, of course, they shout in victory and they run to greet him. They can't wait to do to him as he had done to them, because he had done to them as they had done to him on account of what they had done to him for what he had done to them because of what they had done to him. Verse 14 tells us the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and the new ropes tying his hands simply melted like burning flax. But then Samson noticed a fresh donkey jawbone. Now, this is not a weapon, okay? A donkey jawbone, maybe one-on-one a weapon like this could be used. This is not a new one, the fresh one. This is a dry one in the picture. It could extend a person's reach, and it was hard. You could club someone with it. But an entire army? Not a chance this is going to be an effective weapon. It's a terrible weapon. We've already seen, though, that Samson can tear apart a lion with his bare hands. The author says, you know, like you and I tear apart a young goat. Just rip it. I mean, it's what's available, though. So what choice does Samson really have? Well, for one thing, he could have chosen to honor the Lord and his Nazarite vow. When the author points out it's a fresh donkey jawbone, he means the donkey had recently died. It was still wet with donkey blood. Now, dried bone was not considered to be a corpse, right? Bones often were used as knife handles, for example. And even though Samson's under a Nazarite vow, he could use such a knife. Meat, even though it's butchered from a dead animal, once it's butchered, is not considered unclean. And so while Samson could eat meat, he couldn't butcher the animal. This jawbone is fresh. Not only is Samson breaking his Nazarite vow by using it as a weapon, he is doing so even as he is being empowered by the Holy Spirit of God. Again, what choice did he have? Well, I could have chosen to trust the Lord. See, faith results in obedience. The Spirit of God rushes on him, and the strongest ropes available were nothing to him. I imagine the scene, like the scene in the movie Superman, where Superman allows himself to be handcuffed, captured, right, and put into handcuffs. Lois Lane asks him why he allowed them to put him in cuffs, and he just said, look, it makes him feel safer. And then he just gets up and snaps the cuffs as if they weren't there in order to talk to these military officers behind the one-way mirror that he can see through.
You let them handcuff you?
Wouldn't be much of a surrender if I resisted. And if it makes them feel more secure.
Let's put our cards on the table here, General.
You're scared of me because you can't control me. You don't. And you never will.
That is such a flex. He doesn't budge. Samson has no reason to fear the Philistines. He could have chosen faithfulness, though. Even if not picking up the donkey jawbone would have led to his death, at least he would have died faithfully. But there were other choices available to him. You see, he could have fought them with his bare hands. We saw what he could do with a lion. He could have simply taken a sword from the nearest Philistine. He could have done that. He had choices. Instead, he chose to defile himself and once again break his Nazarite vow and thereby dishonor the Lord, even as the Lord is using him to deliver Israel. Samson struck down 1,000 Philistines. This is the point. He could have called to the 3,000 men from Judah who are with him to engage in the battle and defeat the Philistines. They were still there. This is the point. He could have delivered Israel, which was his calling as a judge. He doesn't call them to engage, though. He struck down 1,000 Philistines and apparently just called it quits. That's more likely that the Philistines fled the battlefield. And you see one guy taking out all these men, like, I'm done. I think I got to go home. Bread's in the oven. We've seen God put entire armies to flight. In fact, the author of Hebrews says that's what happened. Men like Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David put foreign armies to flight. Look, God was fighting for Israel. God had been seeking opportunity to deliver Israel, and this is it. This is the opportunity God has been working toward. The Philistine army is all together. All that is needed for victory is faith. If Samson will engage in the full battle, if he will rise up in faith, God will defeat the entire Philistine army and deliver his people from their oppression. Samson isn't fighting for the Lord, however. Now, we know this because of what happened after the battle. He defeated 1,000 soldiers and apparently took the time to pile up their bodies. Now, in the course of battle, as he's striking down the enemy, he's not defiling himself. They're dying as he's striking them. He's not defiling himself in the act of battling. He's doing what the Lord has called him to do. It is when he goes back to those who have died and grabs their dead bodies and piles them up into heaps that he further defiles himself. Now, ritual uncleanness is not the same as being dirty. That's not what it means. It's more of a status. When he struck down someone, he was doing what the Lord called him to do. When he killed a lion, for example, he was in the act of killing it. He does not make himself unclean with the lion's body until he goes back and touches its rotting carcass. So here he doesn't make himself unclean until he piles up the dead bodies. In verse 16, Samson, who, remember, loves riddles and puns, says, "With the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey have I struck down 1,000 men." Now, we miss the pun in English. The word for donkey is the same as the word for heap. D.A. Peters, an Old Testament scholar, he suggests a different translation. "With the jawbone of an ass, I made asses out of them. With the jawbone of a donkey, I have slain 1,000 men." Notice, however, the victory cry has nothing to do with the Lord. You know, the one who performed the miracle that his mother would conceive, the one who called him from the womb to serve him, the one who consecrated him to himself for his entire life. Samson utterly and completely failed to acknowledge the Lord, preferring instead to memorialize himself with a little victory ditty. He even named the place Ramoth Lehi, Jawbone Hill. See, when folk would walk by in days to come and they see a hill made out of human skeletons, they would think of Samson, the great Samson. Do you remember the song of Deborah and Barak back earlier in the book? After God rescued Israel from the king of Hazor, a powerful enemy, they said, "Hear, O kings, give ear, O princes. To the Lord I will sing. I will make melody to the Lord, the God of Israel. Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the region of Edom, the earth trembled and the heavens dropped. Yes, the clouds dropped with water. The mountains quaked before the Lord. Even Sinai before the Lord, the God of Israel." Remember in that battle, the Israelites faced over 900 chariots made out of iron. That was an overwhelming force. They had no business on the battlefield against such overwhelming odds. Yet, these iron chariots were rendered useless when the Lord sent rain and overflowed the Kishon River, causing them to become stuck in mud. God received the glory and honor for the battle, even as he used his people to bring about that victory. Samson piles up dead bodies as a gruesome monument to his own glory. Oh, he hasn't completely forgotten about the Lord, though. In verse 18, we read, Samson was very thirsty. You know, it's hot, sweaty work, killing 1,000 men with a bloody jawbone and then dragging 1,000 of those bodies into big old piles and taking the time to write a witty little song for others to sing. Samson finally calls upon the Lord. He says, "Yahweh, God of Israel, has granted salvation." Wow. I mean, he did so by the hand of Samson, if you know what I mean. He couldn't do it without him, right? But what salvation is he talking about? Because the Philistine army is still there. They're still around. They're still oppressing Israel. Oh, they've taken a big hit, right? He killed 1,000 of their men, but they're still oppressing Israel. What he means is the Lord has granted Samson personal revenge. They lost 1,000 men, but they're not defeated. Apparently, Samson, for his part, was too thirsty to pursue them. Even Gideon had the motivation to chase Zeba and Zalmunna over 100 miles. And we saw that he, too, was motivated entirely by personal vengeance. Now, when we read Samson's words, at first, it sounds like he's giving God the glory for the victory, but his words are actually an accusation. The ESV renders it as a question, but it's really a question that is more of a statement. You know the kinds of questions people are going to ask. He says essentially, "Oh, sure, you've given me the victory. Good job. But now you're leaving me here to die of thirst so that I end up in the unclean hands of the Philistines." Like, oh, now he's worried about ritual cleanliness, ritual purity. He wasn't concerned about it when he tried to marry a Philistine woman. He wasn't when he defiled himself at a week-long drinking party. He wasn't when he touched a rotting carcass. He wasn't when he grabbed a fresh donkey jawbone. He wasn't when he piled up 1,000 dead bodies. I mean, after all that defilement, after all the times he spat upon his own consecrated life and violated his Nazarite vow, as God continued to empower him, continued to assert his calling of Samson, what makes Samson think the Lord will, after all this, just leave him there to die of thirst? I don't know about you, but if I were the Lord, I would scream in his face, "Who do you think you?" But I'm not the Lord. God performs another miracle and causes fresh water to come out of the ground for Samson. Samson. But the effect is immediate. Samson's spirit is refreshed. His spirit. You see, after a big victory often comes an emotional high, and after that emotional high comes the emotional low. Samson's spirit had sunk as low as his behavior. And yet, God gave him cool, clear water to drink so that Samson's spirit was revived. The author points out the spring was still there when he was writing this. He adds that Samson judged Israel 20 years, but notice when. In the days of the judges. There's no declaration of victory. There's no claim the land had peace those 20 years. There's no indication of deliverance for the people of Israel. There is no indication the land had rest for those 20 years. Instead, during the time the Philistines oppressed and harassed and ruled over Israel, Samson judged Israel. In this story of Samson, I'm really struck by the extraordinary kindness of God. We see his kindness in granting a miracle to Samson's mother, for though she was barren, she conceived and gave birth to a son. We see his kindness in calling Samson to a life of service to the Lord and to the people of Israel. We see his kindness in empowering Samson to do the right thing. We see his kindness in showing mercy to Samson and showing it repeatedly. We even see his kindness in giving water to a whiner. Remember that Samson is, in a real sense, Israel. He's presented in the book of Judges as the ideal Israelite. He is everything Israel is, chosen, consecrated, called by God. But he's everything Israel is, rebellious, self-centered, disobedient. There is one way in which Samson was different, however, in which Samson was not quite like the rest of Israel. And that is, Samson is never said to have bowed down to an idol. Now, Gideon, despite his beginning, made a golden ephod. Remember, it caused all Israel to lust after it, to worship it. Abimelech, of course, was an idolater through and through. Jephthah tried to worship Yahweh, God of Israel, as if he were the god Molech when he offered his own daughter as a burnt offering. Samson does not bow to the Baals and to the Ashtaroth. Samson only bows to himself. But Samson is also Israel in another way. See, Samson experienced God's incredible mercy and patience. Through this entire book, a book that many of you have already described as a book that is depressing because of the repeating cycle of unfaithfulness to the Lord, we never get to the positive conditional statement's outcome. What if Israel were faithful to do all that God commanded him to? Then what? We never get there. We're told in the opening of the book that we, the readers, would not get there. Now, many of the judges did have successful careers. Many would deliver Israel from their particular oppressors at that time. But back in chapter 2, the author tells us that as soon as the judge died, Israel, quote, turned back and were more corrupt than their fathers, going after other gods, serving them, and bowing down to them. Yet the Lord remained faithful. Even in his anger, when he raised up another oppressor, he was actually being faithful. See, the oppressors were intended to cause Israel to return to the Lord. What is remarkable to me is God continued to seek opportunity. Remember, we saw in chapter 14 that when Samson insisted on his parents arranging a marriage with a Philistine woman for him, God was active in this. Even in Samson's sin, God was seeking opportunity to bring about the deliverance of his people. God was working behind the scenes, so to speak, to bring about the conflict that would result in Samson gathering an army, as he was called to do, and defeat the Philistines. He would then destroy their altars and their carved images. Israel would then cleanse the land of its idolatry. Even in Samson's sin, many, many sins, God was at work to bring about God's purposes to bless his people. This is because God is always seeking opportunity to bless. It is, as we've been seeing in this book, his default mode. God desires to bless his people, but sin interrupts the blessing. Sin interrupts the immediate experience of that blessing. For while Israel remained under the oppression of the Philistines for Samson's entire 20-year career as a judge, God was still seeking to bless his people. The blessings were, at most, delayed, for God was still working out his purposes. So often, you and I live with an if-then mentality, right? We've talked about this. We tend to think faith is transactional. If we give God what he desires, God will in turn give us what we desire. But often what God is giving us isn't what we think we want, but what God gives us is always what we need and what we truly desire. I mean, think of it. How often does God change us in the midst of our circumstances rather than change our circumstances? Oh, we want our circumstances changed, of course, but once God has changed us, our perspective changes, and we recognize his goodness in changing us. Church, God is ever seeking to opportunity to deliver us. He is eager to bring true blessing into our lives, and that blessing is found most fully in making us more like Jesus. In fact, God has brought about the opportunity. Paul said, I'm sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. Did you notice there's no if in that verse? God began the work because God is the one who began the work of your faith, and God will bring it to completion. That means that as you and I, as we walk through this life, stumbling along imperfectly and even making lots of messes along the way, God is ever at work in our lives bringing about his purposes. Church, the reason faith cannot be transactional is because it is rooted entirely in who Jesus is and entirely in what Jesus has done. Faith is not an if-then proposition. Faith is because Jesus has proposition. Because Jesus has done everything necessary for life and salvation, our response is one of faith, and faith results in obedience. The obedience doesn't secure anything for us. When we obey the Lord, it doesn't actually gain us anything tangible. Our faithful obedience is simply the right response to what Jesus has done, is doing, and will continue to do as he moves us along toward his intended purpose. Because of what Jesus has done, we desire to be ever more faithful. Because of what Jesus has done, we desire to glorify God. Because of what Jesus has done, we desire to live for him. Because of what Jesus has done, we gladly repent of our sin and press on toward the goal that we may honor him. Because of what Jesus has done, we can leave behind guilt and shame and regret, and we can embrace the mercy and the grace and the forgiveness that is ours in Christ. New City, let us not live in the if. Let us live in the because. Because he loves us, because he has done the thing, because of who he is, because of what he's done, let us be faithful.